Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I asked the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now, not ever.
I mean...
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
You know, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hello, Mark Kenny here from ANU's Australian Studies Institute, and I'm really glad you've joined Democracy Sausage this week because I reckon you'll find the discussion particularly rewarding. As always, I'm joined by the political scientist, Dr. Maria Teflaga from ANU's School of Politics and International Relations. Maria, g'day there.
Hello, Mark. And I see that you've had a bit of trouble on Twitter this week. From what I've been able to see on Twitter, that you congratulated the Prime Minister earlier last week for channeling his inner Bob Hawke. And the reaction to that wasn't very pleasant. You got a lot of criticism for that. Do you want to sort of explain to our listeners what was going on there?
Well, it is interesting, actually, because, I mean, the bit of the context here, Maria, is that on Thursday, the Prime Minister did that press conference where he announced free childcare for all. It was a pretty extraordinary reversal. In that particular policy space, of course, a major reversal. The coalition had previously described free childcare as basically socialism, but here it was delivering it. Of course, it also comes on top of all the other things that they've had to do, all the, you know, what is it, roughly $320 billion worth of spending and loan guarantees between the government and the Reserve Bank. So, you know, a really quite extraordinary reversal. And it was accompanied by a lot of quite interesting words or rhetoric from the Prime Minister. He thanked Sally McManus, the ACTU secretary, and other union leaders for their cooperation, the spirit in which all of these things were being done. He talked about togetherness. He talked about the strength of liberal democracies and how Australia, as a strong liberal democracy, would show the world how it can best do respond to this kind of crisis. He said in reference to McManus, he said, you know, fantastic cooperation, and said, you know, there's no blue teams, no red teams, no bosses or union leaders. There's just Australians, and together we'll get through this. And it struck me, if you take the sort of policy substance and the rhetoric around it, it struck me that that was much closer to the kinds of things that Bob Hawke might have said, or indeed other Labor prime ministers, but that whole bringing Australia together rhetoric in particular, than Scott Morrison ever thought he would ever be, and indeed that any of us as observers ever thought he would ever be. And that was the observation I made on Twitter, that he was, that, you know, this was bringing out a part of Scott Morrison that perhaps he didn't even know was there. We certainly didn't. But yeah, the reaction on Twitter was visceral and explosive, really. There were people who instantly and wrongly, in my submission, saw that as a direct comparison between Morrison and Hawke, or suggested that in some way that it was this sort of, you know, egregious insult of Bob Hawke's legacy, when in fact, if anything, it was a sort of a veiled criticism of the past position of Scott Morrison and the recognition that this crisis has required him to junk all of that sort of divisiveness and go to the real strength of Australia, which is the full breadth of its community rather than just sections of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a really interesting pivot to observe in the Prime Minister, one which he's wobbled at quite a few times up until quite recently, because he has been an extraordinarily effective, divisive and partisan figure, right? He's very good at sort of seeing what the edge on an issue is, and is extremely good at simplifying things down to, I guess, you know, a very effective sound bites. And as we've sort of discussed on this podcast in the past, you know, this government has had a tendency to sort of think of everything as a political game, and to sort of view politics and do politics through that lens. But as you've sort of basically said, this kind of a crisis, you can't behave in that kind of way. Like, not only is it grossly ineffective, it's just unconscionable. And so it is interesting that perhaps some of the anger at that sort of earlier way of doing politics has rebounded on you when you sort of rightly noted that the Prime Minister has sort of moved away from that kind of language.
It was interesting. One person even chipped me saying, look, I agree with what you're saying, but you shouldn't be surprised about the emotional response. And I didn't sort of take it any further, but my instinct in response to that was to say, well, hang on, so you're actually saying that you believe I'm correct here, but rather than actually go out there onto Twitter and say that, you have a crack at me for saying something that might be a bit inflammatory. Well, I mean, you know, it doesn't really say a lot for the depth of analysis or nuanced argument on Twitter, which I guess we shouldn't be that surprised about. But I don't know. I think there's this – perhaps it is a product of a very polarized polity that we now have, that there's so much pent-up distaste for the Prime Minister and his party over a period of time, that even if – and I'm just talking about if here, don't misunderstand me, but even if it adopted every single policy of the other side, that would still be, you know, it would still be not enough for the people who are of that particular political persuasion that want those alternative policies. They would still not accept it because, in a sense, politics is an emotional business as well as a rational business.
I'd say it was more emotional than rational a lot of the time.
Yeah. Well, I guess that this proves it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's bring in our other guests now. I'm sure they've got views on this and many other things. Dr. Anna Greta Hunter is not just a cardiologist. She's also an ANU Human Futures Fellow from the College of Health and Medicine, and some of her work involves considering existential risks. Hi, Anna Greta. There's a few of them around at the moment. How would you actually define an existential risk?
Hi, Mark. It's great to be with you again. Existential risks, I think, is increasingly topical at the moment. Existential, I guess, comes back to the core of human existence and the questions that are confronting us, perhaps starting last year through the bushfire season and really getting us to think deeply about the human effects of climate change. But there's a list of existential risks, and there's about 10 that have been identified by a group called the Commission for the Human Future. And that list includes environmental degradation and loss of fundamental things that keep us alive, like water. But along that list of existential risks is pandemics. And there are other things on the list that we haven't got to yet, including things like war. So it's a great time to be thinking about what risks are faced, not just as an individual, but as a society, and how we might best respond to them.
Yes, and what's particularly interesting, I guess, is how those risks, when they materialise, how they make what changes they force on a society. And we can get into a little bit of that because we're seeing in real time changes being forced on our society and indeed on communities right around the world. And it will be interesting to see which of those turn out to be lasting and the extent to which things are able to go back to the way they were. And I guess that will that's not something we can know at this stage. Let's also bring in our other guest. I'm delighted to welcome an old colleague from the Press Gallery, Crikey's perspicacious politics editor and an unfailing friend to greyhounds everywhere, Dr. Bernard Keane. How are you, Bernard?
I'm good, thank you.
And your greyhounds?
She's doing very well. She's loving this period of lockdown, which brings her greater time with the humans. So thumbs up from her for our public health policies.
Yeah, that's the case for pets all over the place, including my little schnauzer, very happy about the fact that, I'm pretty much home most of the time and that means that he's looking for my attention a lot of the time. So not always great for productivity, but good for the human spirit. Now, Bernard, when you and I regularly trudged the halls of power, all the talk from the coalition was of fiscal tightening and balanced budgets and union thuggery and these types of things. What's happened? I mean, you don't hear much of that at the moment.
It's the world turned upside down, isn't it? Particularly on fiscal policy. I mean, we sat through all those years of coalition criticism of Labor's response to the financial crisis. They voted against it. I recall even Malcolm Turnbull saying that he'd support the first Rudd stimulus package, but of course they would have done it differently. He had to caveat that support, and they refused to back it. The second much larger stimulus package, that's all gone by the board now. We may not be hearing about Labor's debt and deficit disaster for many years to come, given that at about $130 billion, just the third tranche of the government's rescue packages is a good whack of the entire sum of Labor's deficit spending while it was in power. So, in one fell swoop, the coalition has outdistanced Labor, and I can't see the fiscal position recovering anytime soon. I mean, the government's got to get back to surplus in order to start paying down that debt. And I think, as Wayne Swan found, Josh Frydenberg's going to discover that the recovery in the economy does not translate into a recovery in revenue. So,
Let alone a snapback.
Well, I think there'll be a snapback in some sections of the economy, but I think for large parts of it, it's going to be a long, long, slow grind rather than a snapback. And when it comes to company tax revenues, I think Josh Frydenberg, as I suspect Treasury is already telling him, is not going to see any snapback. So the return to having just narrowly missed out on a surplus due to the bushfires and the virus crisis, the government's now got to do it all again and begin that long, slow process of going back to surplus. Then they can start paying off the remarkable amount of money that they've rightly accumulated just over such an incredibly short space of time. I mean, that's the other amazing thing about this is, I mean, it took months and months between Kevin Rudd's first and second stimulus packages. I think it was 18 days between the first and the third stimulus packages for Scott Morrison. That just illustrates how quickly this whole crisis has moved and the policy response to it has moved.
And in fact, if there was any sort of lag, it was really in the period between when it was recognised that a stimulus package would be necessary and when that first stimulus package arrived. There was a fair bit of chin scratching and preparation that went into that, and it was a reasonably precise package, $17.6 billion, and the government had been using language like it was going to be measured and proportionate and these kinds of things. Really, by the time the second one came along, you were in what Hunter S. Thompson might have referred to as million-pound shithammer territory. Just throw every single thing you can throw at it, really, because that's how big the scale of this thing is. So really, it is going to be hard to imagine politics going back to, not just in terms of budget management, but in terms of the kind of budget and economic discourse that surrounds the transaction of politics, that has defined the transaction of Australian politics for so long now. It's hard to see most of that language coming back.
I think that first package will be the last symbol of that era that is now finished. I mean, that package was about stimulus. It was about encouraging investment by firms. It was about putting a little bit of stimulus into a stagnant economy. It would have been a really good package a week before it was actually released. By the time it actually was released, we had actually moved into the virus world. And the virus world is a completely different one with completely different needs, as the government obviously realised pretty quickly. So, no, we're not going to go back to that era. And You know, the moment that second package came out, it illustrated that we've moved into a completely different world in fiscal and economic terms.
And we need to change the language, don't we? We need to stop talking about stimulus and start talking about either hibernation or support. You know, the economics of this is so very, very different. We can't get people out there doing more, making more, shopping more. We need people to stay home. And so the language around this needs to radically change, which is why you're exactly right, that first stimulus should be the very last one for quite a long time.
Do we actually know whether or not our political leaders really do believe in this concept of a snapback, or is this something they're rhetorically sort of saying as they prepare us for the reality that there is very likely many unknown unknowns about what will happen with the virus, how that will affect the economy, how that will change the shape of the economy going forward, which may be good, which may be bad?
Well, I think it's a very good question about the snapback. It strikes me that it is probably a rhetorical device that is designed to frame and justify as much as possible a return to some sort of fiscal discipline, you know, some sort of levels of fiscal discipline pre-crisis. Whether, of course, it works is another matter. I mean, whether it works as a rhetorical device, let alone whether it's the right thing policy-wise, I guess, although those things are both unknowns. But a government that has made its whole reputation, really, until this crisis, on this whole notion of fiscal rectitude, of balancing in the budget and delivering a surplus, of delivering tax cuts, of being for small government, of being against unions, all of these sorts of things, it's had such a utterly sort of amazing policy shapeshift across all of these areas, and it's looking for a path back. And you know, when you're giving people free childcare, when you've doubled the unemployment benefit, something that should have happened a long time ago, and this is, I'd be interested in your thoughts, anyone's thoughts really on this, but when you've doubled the unemployment benefit, I mean, you've effectively recognised that it was unconscionably low, and when a whole lot of people were about to be dumped onto the unemployment queue, they weren't going to be able to live on $40 a day. And these were, you know, I mean, these were people who were working up until, you know, this moment, and suddenly they were going to be put well below the poverty line. So I don't know. I think the snapback is, as much as anything else, a kind of a rhetorical, you know, piece of scaffold to justify where they are at the moment.
And I think that's a space we really need to be exploring. So snapback, I think, is probably a fantasy that we can imagine that life goes back in some way to how things were previously. Most of the work that's been done looking at the experience of pandemics in human history suggests that that's not the case, that the world we go back to is something that's quite different. So what lies ahead is probably something we should be spending time considering and imagining. And I agree completely with you about New Start, Mark. It's so good to see the government actually beginning to provide people with adequate support when they need it. It might be that the new world that we have is one in which we take care of each other more convincingly than we've done before. It's an extraordinary opportunity for some transformative change.
Well, remember that the government's view is that the increase in Newstart, or the additional allowance, is only temporary. That it is, the idea is it will go back down when this crisis is over. Now, I find it very difficult to believe that the government is going to be able to do that. And that tough decision, if they ever contemplate it, is emblematic of a range of tough decisions they're going to have to make about withdrawing elements of this spending. Not so much in terms of, are we going to have free childcare forever? No, we're not. But at what point do you withdraw those benefits? Because any point that you decide on is going to be arbitrary. There's going to be some people who will miss out. There's going to be some people who have got lucky. As a result, there will always be an element of unfairness. At what point do you actually do that? So that's one set of decisions around withdrawing the immediate survival measures that the government's put in place. Obviously, the government's going to be keen to do it as soon as possible because of the sheer cost of it. But there are both political and economic ramifications of the timing of that. That's one set of decisions. The other set of decisions, of course, is going forward, what the broad fiscal policy is actually going to be. How do you get back to surplus? How do you start paying off that debt? It's, you know, fortunately at extraordinarily, historically low interest rates that the government's been able to borrow at. But even so, it's going to want to move back to surplus as quickly as possible and start paying down that debt. And therefore, that raises the question, how's it going to do that? Is it going to cut spending? Is it going to increase taxes? Is it going to close tax loopholes? There's already people coming forward with all sorts of suggestions from both sides of politics. But that's a whole debate that is going to need to be had afresh once we're kind of through that immediate post-crisis period of some sort of return to, you know, the new normal, whatever that new normal looks like, but what will become the new normal.
I mean, another way of sort of thinking about that, you know, and I agree with what you've said, Bernard, is that, I mean, basically since the GFC, we have been having a growing conversation about inequality in this country and the way our policy settings kind of operate in terms of how we distribute tax dollars to different parts of society. And in recent times, that has become increasingly about generational inequality or perceived generational inequality. And this virus, which also has differing generational impacts for those who are most at risk and the sacrifices being made by young people to protect our most vulnerable, which I entirely agree with, but it does sort of hang a lantern on the fact that young people are being asked to sacrifice a lot in terms of their personal freedoms and their earning capacity. And to snap back to the world that we were in before, I'm not sure if that's going to be politically tenable when so much of state support right now is geared towards helping or basically propping up the lifestyles of far more wealthy older Australians through vehicles like franking credits or negative gearing or other kinds of tax arrangements that are disproportionately beneficial to people who already have wealth and assets.
That's a really good point that you raised there, Maria. I think in terms of the the sort of, I guess, the nature of our society, our assessment of the role of the state, of the role of government, all of these things have suddenly been put under the spotlight. And I think we should consider those more. We'll take a quick break and come back and talk about those.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back, Bernard. Just before the break, Maria was talking about the sacrifice that young people are being asked to make in terms of personal freedoms, I suppose, in the short term. But, this is much more structural, I guess, in terms of the long-term economic implications for many people, including the shutdown of the economy, effectively, and people losing their jobs. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, Maria's absolutely right. I mean, this is the cost of this, of our response to the crisis. Has disproportionately fallen on young people. Unlike any recession I can remember, this economic contraction, which is what it will become, has begun in the services sector of the economy, hospitality and retail, which disproportionately feature or intends to provide jobs for young people. So they're the frontline casualties of this. Obviously, the social impacts are greatest for young people. I mean, for a middle-aged sort of person like me who can work from home and doesn't actually much like socializing anyway, it's not overly inconvenient to actually be locked down. But for your average young person who can't go to uni, can't go out socializing, can't play sport, have lost their job, and if they're at home with their parents, they may have to rely more on their parents. If they're in a share house, they're probably doing it really tough. I mean, the burden really has fallen on them, and the burden is going to continue to fall on them over the next 30 years because of they're the taxpayers of the 2020s and 30s and 40s. They're going to be bearing this fiscal burden for a long time to come. So they're doing an awful lot for older Australians. Yes, this virus does affect younger people, but we know the numbers tell us that this is disproportionately hitting older people in terms of health impacts.
Anna Greta, the Financial Times has written an interesting editorial along these lines where it talks about the virus disproportionately taking out the elderly, but the economic shutdown and the implications from that having a similarly devastating effect on young people or on those at the bottom end of the income distribution curve, people who are vulnerable, whose toehold in the economy is not strong, who are perhaps casual and so forth. So it is really a big concern, isn't it, the sort of social aspect of this? It's not something we can easily dismiss.
No, absolutely. And so it's an opportunity for us to be all thinking very much about issues to do with equity and justice within our society. It is an opportunity as we're discussing, you know, the economic reframing as we recover from the coronavirus epidemic. We are in a position to potentially really look at these issues of intergenerational justice and equity and the ways in which we might be better supportive to those who have historically not done as well. I think the opportunities for really significant change are quite profound. There's a lot of us sitting at home enjoying time with our family and enjoying a slightly slower life. We should be trying to encourage discussions around what it is about this period which is beneficial and the way in which we want to see the society that we're in emerging at the end of this epidemic.
I think one of the things that is currently really under-discussed is the disproportionate gender impact of this, right? Like services, retail, these disproportionately employ women. Childcare is an issue that is disproportionately affecting women. We've seen rates of people calling up domestic violence services surge. And the reality of managing a home and the domestic sphere now that everyone is there is still something that disproportionately affects women. And I think this is something that we haven't sort of discussed enough. And I just wonder whether or not, you know, one can really take back free childcare once it's been given the sort of disproportionate effect that it has on women in the workplace, and whether or not we might see a change around how we discuss what the state's role is going to be going forward, given that this is such a big systemic shock coming after at least a decade of the disintegration of the old policy paradigm. Like, this is precisely the time when big changes happen. Some of them may be good. Some of them may be terrifying.
It's a fascinating point you make about free childcare, for example, because I think one of the glaring realities coming out of this sudden change in everything that we do and the way the economy is working or not working and the way we are all in our homes and doing things differently, one of the things that's coming out of it is we're getting a reframing of who does the important work in our communities. And there's a pretty interesting correlation between quite a number of people who do very valued work who get paid bugger all, let's face it, who don't get paid well, who aren't doing well out of the economy. Obviously, that goes to people like hospital cleaners, but it goes to, you know, Uber drivers, it goes to the truck drivers that are supplying the supermarkets which are keeping the food up to us. It goes to teachers, it goes to early childhood educators in so-called childcare centres, and obviously it goes to nurses. I mean, there are whole numbers of people who are doing critical things which are essential, which this government has had to recognise are essential to the basic functioning of the economy, and one wonders whether that might help us all in a reframing of the value of those people's contributions and how they ought to be remunerated.
So I think these are really, really important questions for us all to be considering. You know, what are the important things that we can all enjoy doing with our time? What should we be valuing in our society? And how do we design our economic relationships in a way that allow us to be kind, to foster togetherness, to see a collaboration, to work in a society where we are actually all represented in some way, shape, or form. We address some of the issues within inequity and the intergenerational problems with justice, or in fact, much broader than that. It's a great opportunity for reflection this period, sitting at home looking after children or sitting at home on your own. And I guess for many people, we're seeing a tremendous amount of background anxiety in the community. And I think one of the ways in which we can contend with anxiety, if we think about the work that's been done in climate change space, is that thinking about action and how we might take some involvement, some participation in this process might help us all to deal with the mental health effects of this, which no doubt will be affecting many of us.
Bernard, you've been around for a long time, as indeed I have, commentating on national politics, public affairs. Do you have any sense of whether what we're talking about now is overly optimistic, that idea that we're in this sort of cathartic moment and that society might actually change for the better as a result of this crisis, or are you a bit more cynical than that?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm more cynical. I probably am, but I'm hearing a lot of things that I heard 10, 12 years ago in the wake of the financial crisis about how that would be a permanent change in economies now, and in areas like fiscal policy. Now, that turned out to be true, but not in the way that anyone thought. I mean, I think the rise of populism in countries like the UK and the US is a delayed and lingering reaction to a lot of what happened between 2008 and 2010. But a lot of the talk back then of a resurgence of Keynesianism, a resurgence of progressive policies never came to bear, I think.
Well, we've got a resurgence of Keynesianism now.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's as the famous saying, we're all, everyone in a foxhole, everyone's a Keynesian. The moment that a crisis comes back, then no matter how monetarist people are, or no matter how dogged they are as an enthusiast of Milton Friedman.
John Maynard
Keynes. Yeah. Yes. I don't think it's to me. I'm an enthusiast of Milton Keynes.
Milton Keynes, isn't that a place?
It is. Not a particularly nice place. No matter how ardently neoliberal they are, they, for the most part, they'll turn to the government and say help when the pressure's on. I think there's reason to think that this time around will be different to 10 years ago. I think partly because we've got a second dose of the same lesson, and this time it's conservative governments who are resorting to extraordinary fiscal measures, whereas it's the Tories over in the UK or the coalition here on a much bigger scale than we saw in the aftermath of the financial crisis.
That's a really good point, actually, Bernard, because it makes me wonder, and I'll be interested in everyone's thoughts on this. Everyone expected Bill Shorten to win the last election. Scott Morrison came through in, surprising circumstances. It was a big shock. The polls all said it was going the other way. There were very few people who predicted it, right? So suddenly we've got this government. It arrives. It doesn't really have much of an agenda. Gets its tax cuts through very quickly. And then, basically there's a fair bit of thumb twiddling. Oh, I know what we'll do. We'll beat up the unions and get some religious freedom bill happening. And, this pretty much framed the agenda of the government. This thing's come along and has, fundamentally changed all of that. I just wonder, had it gone the way the polls suggested, would we be in a worse position in the sense that the bipartisanship we're seeing from Labor, would the coalition have stood by as an opposition and allowed a Labor government to spend $130 billion on direct wage subsidies, for example?
I think there's very little chance they would have been happy to wave through $130 billion. I think maybe the first two packages, perhaps, but going that extraordinary extent that Scott Morrison went in the third package, I don't think the coalition in opposition would ever have balked. I think they would have completely balked
They would have seen it as part of a piece. Sorry to cut you off, but they would have seen it as, you know, just part of a piece of the sort of excess that they claimed had framed Labor's response to the GFC.
Exactly. This is what Labor does. Is run up these, you know, enormous bills, and we have to clean up the mess. So we would have just relived, in a way, what happened 12 years ago, despite the fact that over in the UK there's a Tory government sort of spending even much more than we are in propping up a government. I mean, but this government, the Morrison government, also the Turnbull government to an extent before it, has also went down a much more interventionist path than the Howard government did. I mean, if you look at banking, after the sort of drag kicking and screaming to a royal commission, they've been implementing a very interventionist and highly regulatory regime there. Ditto for energy. They're spending a lot. They're investing a lot in health, investing a lot in education when they embraced Gonski. So this is a coalition that, for, you know, even though it looks very similar, and in some ways has not moved on from the era of John Howard and Tony Abbott, is actually a very different creature in terms of its policies, much more interventionist, much more inclined to spend money. And I think that also tends to mean that what's happened this time around is probably going to stick, you know, or much more likely to stick in a way that, you know, we as I said before, the mooted changes in the wake of the financial crisis never really did stick. We just kind of went, you know, the return to neoliberalism happened reasonably quickly. I just can't see that happening this time around.
I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. I mean, this is a government that really has tried very, very, very hard not to raise Newstart, and they've been quite deliberate in their financial policies to not provide assistance to those at the bottom end of the spectrum. But I think if the parliamentary balance was in the other direction, that we would still be having a stimulus that's along the same lines. I think the optics of having people outside Centrelink looking for government assistance makes it really, really hard to oppose any of the financial measures that have been put in place by any side of government. I've no doubt that all of us who are speaking on this podcast today have met people, have friends, have close members of the family even, who may have lost work or lost income. This is a deeply, deeply personal experience, the economics of the coronavirus epidemic. It's a different financial crisis to the 2009 event. The drying up of both supply and demand at the same time is quite an extraordinary thing for a government to have to contend with. And I think that's how the narrative runs, is that this is totally different to what we've contended with before.
I think the important thing, though, is that, one, we have been living with the aftershocks of the GFC for more than a decade. As a society, came off a period of extraordinary, once-in-a-century style growth, and we've all sort of adjusted or been struggling to adjust to the reality of that before the coronavirus. So that sense, that discourse about, well, something is not quite right in the Kingdom of Australia, has been there for quite a while. But perhaps more importantly is that this government is being driven by events, and they are responding to events. And that doesn't mean that ideology will go away. I mean, that's already quite clear in the way the government has chosen to respond to this crisis, and which policy levers they've chosen to pull, and under which frameworks and under which reasonings, and those that they haven't. But just because they are sort of being pushed by events, it may be the case that they have to do things that they would never have kind of considered, but they've also got a whole bunch of choices that I think are kind of predictable for us to sort of think about, like what are they going to do about the tax cuts they've already legislated, for example. You know, given the choices they have to actually pay down debt, you know, how much more can, like, is it really feasible for them to continue to sort of screw down welfare recipients when people who are not traditionally on welfare are likely to still be unemployed in a year's time?
Well, that's all right. I mean, I think the point you make about the change that the government's going to have to undergo in terms of its thinking about welfare is a really interesting one. I guess what I was kind of thinking about in terms of the politics of it was that, you know, it took a Labor government really to do the kind of industrial relations reform that we saw through the early and mid 90s. It took a conservative government, I think, to successfully do the crackdown on firearms, on, you know, to do gun control. In a sense, it takes governments of the other stripe, as it were, or of the same stripe, really, but, you know, acting on behalf of the community against their own what might be seen as a vested interest. And I think to some extent we were fortunate that this came along with a conservative government in place, because I do think the, you know, going to Bernard's point, I do think the chance of there being political consensus on all aspects of this spending, given the GFC record, is fairly low. I think that chances are that there would have been a lot more discord about it. And to that extent, there may have been some greater political nervousness about dialing in the sort of protection that we've seen, you know, put into the economy. So perhaps in that sense, and I only say in that sense, but, you know, perhaps in that sense, those on the most vulnerable end of the labour market we're lucky that that's the way the politics shook out.
It is a rather damning indictment of the coalition's behaviour of the last 12 years. That is devastating.
Well, I think you can make that assessment reasonably fairly on the basis of its constant carping about the GFC. I mean, Australia was one of the few countries that actually steered around a recession in the GFC. As we've noted on this podcast before, in the middle of these crises, you're only ever dealing with fragments of information. You don't know what comes next. That was the nature of the sort of GFC as it rolled out. It was unclear the extent to which it would go, what the economic fallout would be from it. And Treasury advised the government, you know, go hard, go early, go households, get money into people's pockets, get demand happening in the economy. And of course, the government spent a fair bit of money doing that. There was those checks, and there was also the infrastructure programs and the like. The coalition's never stopped bleating on about it, even though it was successful. There were some elements of it, in hindsight, that you can say were not good, and clearly some aspects of it just were wasteful. But you can't know that at the time. There will be many aspects of what has been done here that will emerge to be wasteful, but you can't know it ahead of time. And if you go through the normal processes of government, well, that's not what you do in a crisis, because if you do, you'll be about 6 or 8 months behind what is needed, and that's the path to, you know, depression.
And isn't that interesting, just to think that if you go back to 2009, most of us wouldn't have had direct experience with people who had, you know, financial devastation, and that was one of the extraordinary things about the Australian response, is that we didn't see the devastation that was seen across large parts of the world. This is a different crisis. This is one where we all know someone. We know someone who might have had the virus. We know someone who's been locked in their house for a long period of time. We know someone who's lost their job. We know someone who might be losing their business. So this is a much more personal experience than last time.
Yeah, and I think what's going to be really fascinating also is, and is quite a worry, is the extent to which the private economy, the private sector is different, is transformed as a result of this. I was talking to a friend yesterday who has a business, and his business has been absolutely savaged by this sudden shutdown. He expects to take a significant loss, but nonetheless had a pretty upbeat attitude talking about coming back after the shutdown in a much smaller and more modest form, using, digital technology in a much more efficient way, hiring fewer people and essentially running the same operation but in a much more modest way. Now, you might say, well, that's a great thing for efficiency in the economy, but it doesn't sound like a great thing for, for a rebound in the labour market. And we expect the same sorts of things to happen to, you know, the big employers we know about, like Virgin and Qantas, who have stood down, you know, the bulk of their workforce. It's hard to imagine that they'll be rehiring all of those people. In fact, Virgin's been quite clear that at least 1,000 of those people won't be rehiring. And this story is going to be written a million times across the economy. So going back to the question about New Start, as it was called erroneously, I can't imagine them being able to, that they may not keep it at exactly the same level, but I can't imagine them taking it back to where it was.
No, I mean, there's a, I mean, the The New Start is a peculiar case because literally everyone other than the government, including John Howard, including elements of the government itself, including and Nationals, the Business Council. Business Council, you know, it's the first time I'll say anything good about the Business Council. They've been pushing for a New Start increase for years. So there was virtually universal consensus that it was too low. And now, as you said earlier, the government's admitted that it was, it is or what was too low. And yeah, there is, I mean, there is certainly not going to be any snapback in terms of employment. It's going to be a long, slow grind for a lot of businesses. I mean, the head of Air New Zealand a couple of weeks back said when he announced that they were basically shutting up shop that he expected in a year's time they would only have 30% of their current employment. Now, that's in a year's time. Not every business is going to be like the airlines. The airlines are front and center in terms of the impact. But that gives you an idea of just how slow some economies are actually going to be and how many businesses are operating at the moment and discovering that, oh, hey, hang on. Well, we can actually keep on ticking over at a reasonable level with everyone working from home. Do we actually need all that office space? Do we actually need our travel budget like that? They're going to start thinking about, well, let's give up part of our office lease. That's going to have flow-through implications for a commercial property market and for the banks. It's going to have lingering issues for airlines and the travel market. So there are all sorts of areas where implications that we don't really understand have a long way to go yet. And it's very, very difficult for policymakers because they're just as much in the dark. They can speculate, but their guess is as good as ours in the sense about what kind of future a lot of individual sectors of the economy have over the medium term in terms of how this has affected them and how they choose to respond to how it's unfolded.
So I really want to put forward a pitch for imagination. We are contending with a crisis that we've not been through before. The economics of this particularly are quite singularly unique in contemporary history. It's time for us to imagine what might happen at the end of this. So the patterns of employment, the patterns of our social behaviour, everything is changed. And we can either assume that things might go back to how they were before, or we could use this time to really foster imagination about how we can do things differently and potentially better in the world that we make as we recover.
That's a very excellent point on which to finish, Anna Greta. Thanks so much for that. As I said at the beginning of this podcast, it was going to be an excellent discussion, and I think it really has been a very rich and rewarding one. Thank you to Anna Greta Hunter, Bernard Keane, of course, Maria Tafaga, who's with me each week. Before I go, can I just say that later in the week in our Democracy Sausage Extra series, we'll get a picture from the UK and Europe with two outstanding London-based guests, Elizabeth Ames and Sophia Gaston. And as well as we'll look at the COVID response, we'll also discuss the arrival of the new British Labour leader, Keir Starmer, which is certainly going to change politics in the UK after the long, overly long and pretty pointless Corbyn period. And next week in this space, Maria, on Democracy Sausage, we'll hear perspectives from Tim Costello and from Virginia Hausiger. And you were saying, Maria, earlier that there's a very strong gendered aspect to this COVID crisis and the economic fallout. And Virginia will be very strong on that. So can I thank you all again for being with us. And if you want to contact us, then by all means contact us via Twitter. That's at APPS Policy Forum, APPS Policy Forum, and the Facebook group is Policy Forum Pod. Until next week, goodbye for now.
Bye. Wash your hands.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.